From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The U.S. Census, the attendance, the roll call we take of ourselves every 10 years is under a big cloud of controversy because of the Trump administration move to add the question, is this person responding a citizen of the United States? But the Census Bureau is going ahead with a test census to see what kind of an effect that question will have. Nearly 250,000 randomly selected households will be asked to fill out forms with the question on it. Another 250,000 will fill out forms without it. NPR national correspondent Hansi Lo Wang is here. Hi, Hansi.
Hey, Robin.
So as we know, the census question is being asked or questioned in the courts and in Congress. Last night, the ACLU and other advocacy groups asked the Supreme Court to delay ruling on that citizenship question's legal fate because of newly discovered documents about the alleged motivation of the question. Do we know first what impact that had?
We don't know. We're waiting to see what the Supreme Court will do with this request, and we're still waiting to see what the justices say. We do know that these documents were first disclosed a few weeks ago, where the plaintiff's attorneys got connected with the estranged daughter of a former GOP redistricting strategist, Thomas Hoffler. He died last year. His daughter came across his hard drives, came across files that included documents that the plaintiffs here are alleging that show, they say, a strategy that the Trump administration wanted to use a citizenship question on the 2020 census to ultimately politically benefit Republicans and non-Hispanic white people during the next round of redistricting, the next round of drawing political maps after the 2020 census. The Trump administration says that Thomas Hoffler, his ideas did not play any role in their request for a citizenship question. They say this question was added, they say, to better enforce part of the Voting Rights Act, specifically protections against discrimination of racial and language minorities and their voting rights. But it is a big question right now whether or not the courts will allow these new documents and these new allegations to proceed, and how that might affect the thinking of the Supreme Court as well as the other judges involved in other lawsuits around the country.
Right. And the other piece is yesterday the Trump administration exerted executive privilege over documents related to the origin of the citizenship question because lawmakers have been asking for them as they try to figure out what's their political motivation here. Do we know if those documents were among the documents that the Trump administration refuses to let lawmakers see?
Well, there are a lot of documents. When we're talking about the citizenship question, there was a long paper trail. The documents that the House Oversight and Reform Committee has been asking for from the Trump administration, these are emails, internal emails, memos within the Justice Department and Commerce Department. And some of them we've seen, they've been released before for the lawsuits, but most many of them are heavily redacted. And so the Democrats on the House Oversight Committee said that they want to see the full versions. And right now the Trump administration is pushing back, and they've already previously claimed privileges, attorney-client privilege, say because of ongoing lawsuits, they can't release the full versions of these documents. Now they've, the Trump administration is claiming executive privilege. Ultimately, this could spark another court battle over the citizenship question, specifically about these emails. And the House Democrats are interested in these emails because they want to see if there are any additional clues to what they believe could be the real motivation for this question.
Well, there was already a national study in 2018 that found that the citizenship question could be a huge deterrent to participation in the census. Presumably, people who are in the country illegally would be afraid of exposing themselves. Now, of course, non-citizens can't vote, but this count is how representational districts are carved out. Republicans are saying non-citizens give Democrats an advantage. Democrats are saying there's more to the census than that. It's also used for appropriating federal dollars, and we need to know where everybody is. But what, you know, when the actual testimony was given for the question, what did Republicans say about how this would help them enact the Voting Rights Act if they had the question in it?
Well, this is an argument brought forth by the Trump administration, and the Justice Department submitted a formal letter to the Census Bureau saying that the Trump administration wants to have more detailed citizenship data. There already is citizenship data that the federal government relies on, and it is collected by the Census Bureau, but it's not through the census form. It's through what is known as the American Community Survey. It's a smaller survey. About 1 in 38 households receive it every year. It continues. It's an ongoing survey. But that provides estimates of how many citizens there are in any given community in the country. But that has been adequate for the government to enforce part of the Voting Rights Act, specifically Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. It's relied right on estimates of how many citizens there are in the country of voting age. Mm-hmm. But the Trump administration is making the argument that it wants more detailed citizenship data so it can better enforce that part of the Voting Rights Act. You talk to voting rights advocates, they are skeptical of that reasoning. They don't think there is a data problem. You know, one thing to point out here is that if you were to have more detailed citizenship data, and this is a point that's outlined by Thomas Hoffler, that GOP strategist in one of his files, if you have this detailed citizenship data from a citizenship question on the 2020 census, you are able at the state and local level to draw districts based not on the total population of every person living in the country, living in the area, all residents, which is how it's been done for decades. But instead, you could draw districts solely based on who are just U.S. citizens or citizens of voting age. And that could drastically remake the political map and reshape it after the 2020 census. That is one possible consequence here, not related directly to the enforcement of the better protection of the voting rights of racial minorities.
NPR national correspondent Hansi-Lo Wang, stay right there because I know sitting next to you is our historian, Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton, who helps us put these things in historical perspective. And Julian, we know that the Census Bureau has set July 1st as the deadline they need to start printing the real 2020 forms. That's right around the corner. But what if the founding fathers want? I mean, do we know? Because the Constitution reads, representatives shall be apportioned among the several states according to their respective numbers, counting the whole number of persons in each state, excluding Indians, they wrote, not taxed. Did they debate this? Did we know what they wanted?
Well, it's pretty clear the intention of this is to set up the numerical foundation for apportionment and also for tax purposes. The founders certainly were not where we are today in terms of concepts of citizenship, whether you're talking about Native Americans and slavery. What is clear is in the 20th and 21st century, the direction of politics, of judicial rulings, went against doing what the Trump administration might have been trying to do. So for me, it's less about the founding than 1964 when the Supreme Court issued the one man, one vote ruling and said subtle forms of voter suppression and discrimination needed to end. And what we're seeing now is a reaction to that. And the question is this move an effort to overturn that kind of legitimate count?
Julian, we're going to keep an eye on that story. It is a big one. But I want to ask you about another thing that the president is turning heads on this week. He told George Stephanopoulos of ABC News that if a foreign country offered him dirt on an opponent, like happened in the 2016 election, that he would take it. I think we have that tape now.
I think you might want to listen. There's nothing wrong with listening. If somebody called from a country, Norway, we have information on your opponent. Oh, I think I'd want to hear it.
You want that kind of interference in our elections?
It's not an interference. They have information. I think I'd take it.
Julian, your thoughts. Even the president's allies, people like Lindsey Graham, Senator Lindsey Graham, said that was a mistake.
Well, it is. And that's not legitimate given the kind of information that Stephanopoulos was talking about. And this wasn't an off-the-cuff comment and that we've heard variations of this before. And this gets to the heart of what the 2016 campaign was about, gets to the heart of how he perceives normal rules of law and order. And moments like that are very revealing. But some say President Trump believes at some level strategically by saying everything out in the open, he neutralizes it. Yeah. And if he is saying it, then how can it be wrong? It's the ultimate Nixonian philosophy. But I think, it put a lot of his defenders obviously off base because very few people agree with the president on this.
Well, but what is the law? We know that it's illegal to get financial contributions from a foreign government, but information is, we understand, murkier and it hasn't been tested in court. You know, is it something of value? Is it like money? This is one of the reasons Mueller didn't charge on this because it's a murky area.
It is murky, although FBI Director Wray has said this is something that should be reported to them. We've had other campaigns that get murky information and do turn it over and report it, including Al Gore. And we're also, at least if 2016 is the precedent, talking about stolen information. So you know, given the context of the efforts to intervene in elections, this isn't just free-floating information that comes the president's way. And I think that at some level, President Trump knows that.
Well, and he also said today that taking dirt from foreign governments would be a lot like sitting down with any head of government today. He said, you know, I just met with the Queen of England, but it's not really the same thing, is it?
Well, no, it's not. And we're talking about governments in adversarial relations with the U.S. that are consciously undertaking cyber campaigns to undermine the election. So at some level, the president should have an instinct that says, no, I don't want that. Certainly. And the fact he says it in a public interview is incredibly revealing.
Well, I was just going to say, maybe he's just revealed that that is what he does when he has those off-the-record conversations with leaders like Putin. Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Julian, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
And Hansi Lo Wang, thank you as well.
You're welcome.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Emberwave, the revolutionary new personal thermostat that's designed to help you find thermal wellness in any situation. Emberwave can put you in control of your comfort in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, in restaurants or theaters, after a workout, at home, and more. Learn more at emberwave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. Emberwave, own your temperature.
Music has always stirred us from colonial to modern times, and now the two, history and music, intersect. Historian John Meacham and country music star Tim McGraw have traced our country's history through music in a new book called Songs of America, Patriotism, Protest, and the Music That Made a Nation. They're on a book tour right now with McGraw performing some of the songs they write about. Here now's Lisa Mullins spoke to John Meacham and Tim McGraw, who happen to be neighbors in Nashville, and asked John how this project got started.
Tim asked me a really good question, which was, given the eras of history that I've written about, had I ever thought about the role music played in them? And honestly, I hadn't. And so that was the beginning of this particular journey.
Tim, you write that interwoven in the fabric of our history is music that basically tracks America from the beginning until now. Could you start with the Liberty Song versus
Sure.
the Rebels, what we hear in the lyrics of both those songs?
You know, the Liberty Song to me is probably one of the most fascinating songs to me, certainly because it goes back so far. It was written in 1768 by one of our founding fathers, John Dickinson, and it was written 8 years before the Declaration of Independence, and it had a real prescient view of what he thought our country could be and what it could become and what it could mean for future generations, which was incredible. There's a line in that song that our children shall inherit the fruits of our pain.
Come join hand in hand, brave Americans all, and rouse your bold hearts at fair liberty's call. No tyrannous act shall suppress your just claim or stain with dishonor America's name.
And then the Rebels, it's something that could really anger you. I mean, the way it was written and what it was talking about and how it described
it taunted, the colonists.
Taunted the colonists. So the push and the pull and the rub, it gives you a real reflection on what was going on at the time and how that propelled things forward and how that propelled people to think and take action.
And John, amplify that. I mean, do you hear it any differently as a historian?
I do. I think that the raw materials of history, right, are the letters of an era, the newspapers of an era. I just hadn't thought enough about what was the music they were singing. We talked about the Rebels versus the Liberty mm-hmm. Song. You know, 20-25% or so of the country remained loyalists. So that was the division there. You go to the songs of the enslaved. You go to Dixie versus the Battle Hymn of the Republic. There's no more vivid manifestation of what Lincoln called the fiery trial than those two songs.
Let's hear a bit of both, and you can speak to each of these. First, the Battle Hymn of the Republic.
Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He is trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. He hath loosed the fateful lightning of his terrible swift sword. His truth is marching on.
And then there's Dixie.
I wish I was in the land of cotton, old times there are not forgotten. Look away, look away, look away, Dixieland.
Dixie was written for blackface minstrel singers in New York City. Believe me, we're two white Southerners, and there are a lot of folks who do not know that history. If you understand that Dixie was written for a white guy pretending to be a black man singing nostalgically for enslavement, that puts that song exactly where it should be, which is in a place where it was a manifestation of the worst part of American history, one of the original sins. The original sins of American history are Native American removal and African American slavery. And then the battle hymn is written by Julia Ward Howe in one night. The first time Lincoln heard it, he simply said, "Sing it again." And I think that you hear the tension, you hear the struggle for liberty, and you hear the Southern struggle to avoid and run away from modernity. You hear all of that in those songs in a way that I find incredibly affecting, not just as a Southerner, but as a historian.
Tim, is Dixie a song that you play or would play?
It was a challenging song to dissect when we decided to put the show together and the book tour together and add music to what we were talking about. It was something that we had to really sit down and figure out how we were going to approach and to challenge. Because, as John said, I'm a Southern white kid who grew up in Louisiana, and I grew up in the middle of cotton fields. Cotton fields were the lifeblood of my community. And as I got older and you hear more of what the history of the song is, then your head kicks in and your brain kicks in and you clearly realize what that song's about. So it changes your perspective on it for sure. We perform the song in the show, but we do it in a different way. We wanted to attack it in a different way. And Mickey Newberry, who put together a trilogy of Dixie, Battle Hymn of the Republic, and All My Trials, which is an old Bahamian lullaby. And All My Trials at the end really provides a perfect resolution to both of those songs, and that's the way we approach it live.
John, these songs do often represent different political points of view, different Americas. Talk about Happy Days Are Here Again, which became Franklin Roosevelt's theme song.
Happy days are here again. The skies above are clear again. Let us sing a song of cheer again. Happy days are here again.
And that totally captures, right, the buoyant optimism, that insistent optimism of FDR. But let's remember, that was the optimism, but that's 1933. One out of four American men are out of work. Riots in the Midwest, the Dust Bowl. So the other song that
Brother
represented...
Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? Yeah, absolutely, by Bing Crosby, which was about a soldier coming home from war and not being able to eat, not being able to get the things...
In a bread line,
not being able to live the American dream that he fought for.
Let's hear a little bit of that.
They used to tell me I was building a dream with peace and glory ahead. Why should I be standing in line just waiting for bread?
So songs like that that came to represent what was going on in America from different points of view, did they become popular because they were reflecting what was on people's minds, or did they actually change things? I mean, did they spawn some kind of activity and change?
This agency question about to what extent does it reflect and to what extent does it shape? Somebody like John Lewis, so we interviewed him for the book, and Congressman Lewis said he couldn't imagine the civil rights movement without its music, that it wasn't music that made Rosa Parks do what she did on the 1st of December 1955, but that music, once it happened, kept those unimaginably young and brave folks moving through the storms of trying to apply Jefferson's sentence that we are all created equal more fully. And according to Congressman Lewis, the way to me, the most vivid moment where the powerless intersected with the powerful to move us forward, came in March of 1965, when Lyndon Johnson, after the violence at Selma and Bloody Sunday, a week later goes to the Congress and says, "And we shall overcome." And Congressman Lewis describes sitting with Dr. King in a living room in Selma and both of them crying as the mantra of a movement became the mantra of a president.
That mantra, "We shall overcome," has been used for so many different causes, including outside of the United States. Tim, with all your travels outside the U.S., do you see how that happens and how a song like that, and I don't know if it's words or music, can appeal to different populations at different periods of time?
Sure, but I think music throughout can also always be appropriated for different causes and lyrically what it says and the content that the music has. And sometimes, like I said, we don't know that till years later when someone discovers a song and uses it for a different reason.
And one of the things we want to be really clear about is we understand that protest is an inherent part of patriotism.
Sure.
Music celebrates and critiques. And what you see in the music again and again, and I didn't appreciate this until we did this, to be very clear, is there is a soundtrack to our history. There is a soundtrack to our aspirations. Lift Every Voice and Sing is great, one of the great examples, right? Became the anthem of the NAACP. Becomes what was called the Negro National Anthem, marvelous scholarship on this, written by James Weldon Johnson. That has been lifted not just to lift a heart in a moment, but to lift a country for an age. Mm-hmm. And that's what this great music does.
John Meacham and Tim McGraw. The book is called Songs of America, Patriotism, Protest, and the Music That Made a Nation. So nice to talk to you both. Thank you.
Thank
Pleasure.
You.
Lift every voice and sing till earth and heaven ring. Ring with the harmonies of liberty. Let our rejoicing rise.
Newsflash. Kids can be picky eaters, and that's a problem in school cafeterias where $5 million worth of food is thrown out every day. One program in Georgia is trying to fix this by collecting uneaten food. The thinking is if there are kids who don't want it, there are kids who really do. Georgia Public Broadcasting's Grant Blankenship reports.
Lynn Janes knows she is responsible for some hungry kids.
We have a lot of students who the only times that they really get a full, solid meal is here at school.
Janes is the principal at International Studies Elementary Charter School in Albany, Georgia. That's one of the 1,500 or so schools in the state where, because they don't have much money, students qualify for either low-cost or free lunches. Janes says when she began working here, it was easy to spot the kids in the cafeteria who weren't getting enough to eat at home.
And that was very concerning to me as an elementary principal. Or just as a human being, really, to see that some of our students would just were so hungry they would scarf the food down, and other students who would just toss things away.
The fact that good food was going to waste bothered Albany resident and former teacher Kathy Revel, too.
It was laid on my heart that it was something I needed to do, and I decided I was going to take it on and go with it.
So last year, Kathy Revel came to the school board with a plan. Collect cafeteria food before it got to the trash can, then save it to send home with hungry kids on the weekend. Principal Janes loved what she heard.
We've saved 12 tons out of the landfill. That was as of February.
The program is called Helping Hands Ending Hunger, and it works like this. Once lunch is over, students have to pass two of their classmates who look over their trays for any unopened food that came from the lunch line.
Did you drink your slushie?
I didn't drink that.
That food gets set aside. The food is stored in a closet that's been repurposed with freezers and coolers.
Sugar, that's breakfast bread, some juice. These are frozen fruit cups.
At the end of the week, the food is packed in insulated backpacks for kids to take home. A typical backpack will have about a gallon of milk in half-cup servings, plus things like prepackaged sandwiches, cheese, and fruit. In 6 months, the program has redirected a little more than 21,000 meals. The Helping Hands program was founded by Carla Harward and her daughter Sophie. They were inspired by a family in their town who were spotted looking for food in the trash outside a football game.
I had no idea that, you know, we would even be talking about kids that had nothing to eat anywhere in the United States.
Before they could launch their plan, Harward had to convince the State Department of Health they would not violate Georgia food safety rules. She succeeded and now has what she says is a turnkey guidebook for volunteers to set up food collection at any school.
We have a supply list of equipment that each school should have so that they can follow these food safety protocols.
So far, the program has put together about 300,000 meals in 25 Georgia schools over the last 2 years.
Baby, you got to turn around. You're going to trip somebody. Turn around.
Back in the cafeteria at International Studies Charter in Albany, student teacher Amber Shaw is with her kindergarten students at lunch. Some of them will have backpacks of food to take home later today. For Shaw, that means less worry between now and Monday.
Because you love these kids. You know, they're your kids. So to know that they're okay, they're going home okay, it makes me okay.
And if the kids come to school less hungry on Monday, Shaw says it makes the job of teaching them that much easier too. For Here and Now, I'm Grant Blankenship.
The Pony Express rides again. Hundreds of people are recreating the horse and rider mail delivery service that galvanized the country just before the Civil War. Today's riders are following the original route. The first left St. Joseph, Missouri on Monday. The last rider due in Sacramento on June 20th. But why are people fascinated enough with this history to recreate something every year around this time that lasted a mere 18 months? Well, it's because the Pony Express remains one of the lasting icons of the American West. It's a story told in dime novels and in westerns, like the 1990s TV show The Young Riders.
Have a great ride, kid!
The Pony Express covered the 2,000-mile route in just 10 days, a time so swift it practically made grown men weep. As Jim DeFelice writes in his book, West Like Lightning, The Brief Legendary Ride of the Pony Express. I spoke with DeFelice last year. Take us back to the fall of 1860. That's when your book starts. Abraham Lincoln had just been elected president, and the pony is bringing news of that election across the West. What does the pony represent at that point in American history?
Well, at that point in American history, the pony and the country is kind of at a huge crux. Everybody knows that there's a war coming if Lincoln is elected, and the owners of the Pony Express have put on extra horses, extra riders. They're using the latest technology, the telegraph, to get the information from Missouri all the way to California as quickly as possible. And I use that run to kind of structure the book and talk about not just the Pony Express, but also what's going on in America at that time.
Hmm. What I loved learning about this, I mean, the politics, as you mentioned, were vivid that were happening at the time. But also, this is a story of American business. And there were connections with the pony to some of the biggest names in modern American business today. Wells Fargo and American Express. Explain that.
Well, you know, when we think of the Pony Express now, we think of horses and young men racing across all sorts of different terrain. But that wasn't entirely the plan that William Russell and his two partners, Alexander Majors and William Waddell, were after. They wanted to do that, but that was going to be part of this entire empire to get goods, information, money, and just about anything else that had to move from the Missouri River all the way to California. They not only did they have the Pony Express, they had a stagecoach line. Actually, they had several stagecoach lines. They had ox carts. They had a bank. They had an insurance company. They were basically trying to create an empire. Now, That same plan had been used to great effect less than two decades before in Upper New York when the Erie Canal opened and connected New York City to the West, to what was then the West and what was then the frontier. That company is still with us. It's American Express. So very possibly, had the pony succeeded, we wouldn't be leaving home without the pony rather than American Express.
That is amazing. Well, what about the young men who did the work? You quote from Mark Twain, who wrote about the Pony Express in his book, Roughing It. Twain says, "The pony rider is a little bit of a man, brimful of spirit and endurance." Who are these guys who are making these rides?
They're basically 19, 20, 21-year-olds. They are on the thin side. In a lot of cases, they're fairly short because the lesser load that would be on the horse, the better, and the faster, at least in theory, the faster the horse can go. And they're being paid incredibly well, $100 a month in many instances. And that was when $100 was actually real money. Huh. These guys are the rock stars, the athletes of the day, and everybody lionized them. When they came into town, they didn't have to pay for their drinks. We'll put it that way.
And they earned their money, though, because this was incredibly hard work. It was freezing cold in the winter. It was dangerously hot in the summer. There were vast, empty stretches of open desert. There was a war with Native Americans in the middle of this. I mean, this was not easy work.
Absolutely. And when they went to, when they would stay at one of the stations, they would take two runs a week. They would, they'd sleep in a stable more often than not, or if they were really lucky, in an attic. So they were earning their money, you're right.
And they only lost, one bag of mail the entire time?
Absolutely. But here's the thing about that one bag of mail that disappeared somewhere, probably, we'll let you read the book to get the details, but it turns up later on. So really, these guys were like perfect. They always delivered the mail. Maybe a little late, but that happens.
It was a really tough business. I mean, it was a tough ride, but it was also really hard to make money doing this. It lost tons of cash, and one of the founders was arrested for defrauding the U.S. government through his bond deal to finance the operation. What happened there?
If your business plan calls on counting on a government contract, you may run into a little bit of trouble fulfilling it. And if you're really counting on being able to borrow money from the government that the government doesn't actually have, that also can be a big problem.
It was a complicated time for the U.S. government leading up to the U.S. Civil War.
Absolutely. And that actually ends up helping William Russell, who's the one who, let's face it, he was kiting checks. And we're not talking about cutting $10 checks. These are thousands and thousands and thousands of dollar checks. And he's defrauding people on Wall Street as well as the U.S. government. If he had done it at any other time, he probably would have gone to jail for the rest of his life. But he was fortunate enough, if that's the right word, to do it at a time that the government was in flux. And there were also maybe some congressmen who didn't want all of the details to come out.
But were those financial troubles the reason that the pony collapsed? Because we always hear about the rise of the telegraph at this time, the rise of the railroad. What did the Pony Express end after only 18 months?
Actually, it was the finances, and there's this little thing called the Civil War that disrupt things. The pony was seen as kind of a short-term venture. Russell and his partners wanted to do something really big to capture the imagination of the people in the West and also to get a lot of support from Congress to get $1 million contract from the government to deliver the mail, which would help them build their infrastructure and actually pay a lot of their bills. The plan succeeded in terms of being able to deliver the mail, as we say. They didn't really lose anything. In terms of PR, it was huge. Everybody knew what the Pony Express was. We still do.
And part of the reason we knew is because of Buffalo Bill Cody and his Wild West shows, who helped sort of build the myth and the legend behind the Pony Express.
Absolutely. And Buffalo Bill Cody was the greatest rider of the Pony Express ever.
Huh.
The problem is he never actually rode. But, you know, it's a little technicality.
Right. What you point out in the book that there's so much about this time in history and about the Pony Express, we're not even really sure if it happened. Why is that?
There's a lot of legends that are related to the Old West and to the Pony Express specifically. And I do try to separate fact from fiction, but I still want to celebrate the legends. I mean, they're fun for the most part, and they also speak to kind of a greater truth for us. They tell us about what's important to our country, the distance and speed, but also perseverance. Hmm. When the riders are bragging, they're not bragging about how fast they went 10 miles or 100 miles. They brag about their endurance. They brag about how far they went, the time that they went 360 miles or 380, enduring hardship and just kind of getting through it.
So in this modern age, you think the Pony Express still resonates?
Absolutely.
Jim DeFelice, his book West Like Lightning, The Brief Legendary Ride of the Pony Express, is now out in paperback. We spoke last year, and you can read an excerpt of his book at hereandnow.org. While you're there, you can track the progress of this year's ride.
They rode by night and they rode by day. The job was hard, but they found a way. The Pony Express, they carried the mail. Boys and girls, it was on November the 8th, 1860, at a point on the Platte River opposite Fort Kearney, Nebraska, that a young Pony Express rider by the name of Pony Bob Haslam was handed a message, a very important message. He quickly thrust it into his saddlebag.
Well, the one consolation for Boston sports fans today is they certainly can identify with how it feels to end a drought. And boy, did St. Louis end one last night, winning their first Stanley Cup since the club's founding in 1967 by beating the Boston Bruins in hockey's grand finale on Boston ice 4-1 Game 7. 4-2, I think. And not only that, they went from just about worst to first. Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Am I dreaming that the Bruins got one more goal? I don't think they did. Anyway.
It wouldn't have mattered.
It wouldn't have mattered. Look, yeah. Unless you're a Bruins fan, this is a feel-good story.
Maybe even if you're a Bruins fan, because like you say, well, okay, fine. It is a feel-good story. The worst part of it is at one point they did have, and this point was in 2019, so not, you know, a week into the season. We were in week 15 or 13. They had the fewest points in the league. They had played a few fewer games than some other teams, but they were a severely underperforming team. Let me read to you from a Reddit thread where they do the power rankings. And this was a couple weeks after that. The Blues were then ranked the 27th best team out of the 31 teams in the NHL. And the comment was, they beat good teams and lose to bad teams. The season is likely beyond recovery at this point, but a shakeup in the core is needed. There isn't enough fight in the players. Oh, yeah. They were an underperforming team. Coming into the season, they were seen as a team that could make some noise. But noise in St. Louis is usually a pretty good regular season. And then they lose in the second round of the playoffs, maybe the first. So this was, as you said, the greatest thing ever to happen to hockey in St. Louis.
Yeah, it
ever.
Was really. It was grand. It was grand.
Mike, I asked this question not to be a downer on hockey at all.
Okay.
But
okay.
I'm looking at the calendar. The season started back in October. It is now mid-June. Of course, this happens this way every single season. But does anybody think that the hockey season is too long?
Not hockey fans.
Yeah. Well, it's the same length as the basketball season. And the answer is yes. The players do, except for the economics, especially of hockey, are based on gate revenue. A higher percentage of the owner's profits comes from people actually going to the games as opposed to TV rights. You could make the argument, and the NBA commissioner, Adam Silver, has toyed with, though I doubt he will, shave off a bunch of games. Mm. But if the players want to be paid, and they are paid handsomely, I think it would maybe shock too many people who aren't hockey fans. If you look at the top salaries of a lot of players, they are commensurate with the other big team sports, even though hockey has less of a share of the national attention. But yeah, long story short, it is too long. It makes it less exciting and the games less meaningful, especially when the number one teams in the conference usually lose in the first round. But that's how the money is made.
And it's funny. The only one that really counts is the last one. But I want to just switch to the NBA Finals. Game 6 tonight between the Toronto Raptors and the Golden State Warriors. Did I mention Toronto as in Canada? The Raptors lead the series 3-2. They can win the championship tonight. We've talked about this. You know, no Canadian team, you know, ever made the semifinals in the NHL playoffs. So what's going on here?
Right. Well, this year they haven't. So the last NHL team to the last Canadian team to win the Stanley Cup, Montreal Canadiens, 1993. The Toronto Blue Jays also won the baseball's World Series that year. And since the World Series is played in October, that means, you ready? If Toronto wins, it will be the case that a Canadian team has won in the NBA and in baseball more recently than they've won in the NHL. That's kind of shocking.
Wow.
We are getting a little ahead of ourselves,
yes.
right? Because the Warriors are home and they're without their great superstar, Kevin Durant, who hurt himself in the first quarter.
Busted his Achilles,
Yeah, and he could be out for a year. He was to be the most prized free agent, and there are so many recriminations about who's at fault. The answer just might be it's a bad stroke of luck. He wanted to push himself back from the injury. On the other hand, you know, the GM of the Warriors says, blame me. I don't know if that's taking the hit for the team, or maybe there is some complicity with the, you know, it's very hard when you ask a professional sports franchise, oh, your team of doctors, tell us if the guy's ready. They're going to maybe not take the long-term health of the player into account. What happened to Durant is horrible. If the Warriors lose tonight and the Raptors win, it will mean that one of the great teams in the NBA, the Warriors, will have lost 3 home games in the finals. That seems doubtful. They're favorites. But still, without Durant, the Raptors seem like the better team.
Okay, Mike, let's just cover all the sports, shall we?
Lightning round.
Yeah, people still all the sports. People still talking about that first game of the U.S. World Cup. The women just absolutely destroyed Thailand 13-0. Any debate or question about who's gonna go all the way there?
Or that they should have stopped. You know, that's what they're saying about the U.S. team. You know, should they have taken their foot off the gas? Would they have said the same thing about men if the score went that high?
Okay, in reverse, maybe, but they shouldn't. In both cases, they shouldn't, because not only are this is the highest level of soccer, and, you know, you do get a lot out of playing your hardest, like you get to practice set pieces against real opponents, but, and this should eliminate all debate, goal differential is a tiebreaker. It could come down to goal differential. Every team is not only incentivized, if they don't try to score as much as they can, they're technically going against the spirit of the rules.
Plus,
so you shouldn't debate.
This is adult sports. This is not a children's league, basically. Mike Pesca here, now sports analyst and host of the podcast The Gist at Slate.com. Mike, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. In association with the BBC World Service, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
Robin Young is Here and Now.